Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 7 of the Debaterios podcast. I am one of your hosts, Justin, and I'm joined as always by my wonderful co-host, Oreo. How you doing, Oreo?
I'm good.
All right, and we have a fantastic episode for you guys today. We have another wonderful guest, Bailey Steen. So he goes by atheist underscore CVNT. On Twitter. And first and foremost, he's one of our close personal friends. He's a fantastic guy, just blisteringly intelligent, really, really kind, as illustrated by the fact that he is willing to put up with a 14-hour time difference to record this audio with us. It is currently 1 a.m. where he is from. So we thank him so much for being kind enough to come in here and help us out, help us make another awesome episode. Just introducing him further, he is a prolific writer. He has a bunch of amazing articles out on Medium, just an immensely talented writer. He covers everything from the YouTube censorship to the intellectual dark web and just free speech issues in general. And he approaches it in a very, I know if I say free speech issues, that it comes to your head a certain type of person, but he has some of the most he has some of the most nuanced and balanced takes on the things that you will read on the internet. So we're really excited. Please, everyone, welcome Bailey Steen. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you, Justin. That was a very, very wonderful interview. I feel the grist starting already.
You feel the grist starting already? Awesome. Hey, we're here to make you some money, man. All right? All right. Well, introduce yourself.
In the next 5 minutes, I'll give you some flex tape and why censorship of conservatives is so important.
Well, please begin your grift. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Thankfully, I'm not a grifter. I actually care about free speech and about tech censorship and tech issues in general. I don't just talk about censorship because that is a very basic bitch issue that most conservatives attack tech from. I attack it from a very institutional, critical point of view of tech monopolies, due process, equality for all, and equality for those who deserve it, I suppose, and judging those when they are very, very bad people. And but I do care about censorship in regards to tech and politics as well. So that's usually my area of topic, but I expand out in my professional shit posting career on Twitter. So if you ever want to talk to me about
we've talked about shit posting with Logic Guy in the past. It's a really cool topic for us.
It is an art form. Some people are good at it. Some people you just got a copy of because you don't want to give them the credit for it. So that's my area of expertise sometimes, but we might talk about that.
Oh, of course. So right off the bat, we're noticing a pattern with a few of our guests. Oreo has talked at length about his trip down the YouTube pipeline and how he became he switched from being a conservative to coming a bit more to the left. And you have a bit of a similar story, don't you, Bailey?
I do. I started off I clued into it a bit around near the Gamergate age, but I was very young back then, not even 16, I suppose, but I was hearing those terms of social justice warrior or, hearing the topics of, feminism coming up or people such as Anita Sarkeesian and not so much Zoe Quinn, but in that sort of vein of people who are seen as the enemy by social justice, anti-social justice warrior crowds. Mm-hmm. So I came around that end, but I was still always a progressive sort of person, but never really. And then when 2016 election rolled around, I was very fascinated by Trump in a very cinematic sort of way of he's a big, brutish, villainy, sort of charismatic guy. And I found him very interesting in that regard. And I was I wonder, I might have start cluing into politics because it's a big reality show. And I kind of like reality shows. And that's what I sort of got into Bernie a lot. I remember I was very deeply progressive in that sort of sphere. But then when he lost the election to Hillary and the DNC and all the fuckery that went around then, I remember I started getting really into people who were speaking out about it. And it was a mix between two camps of secular talking Jimmy Dore's sort of side of progressives. And then there was Sargon of Akkad's sort of side of classical libtard, shitposty, fun, reactionary sort of sphere. And I was kind of balancing those two. But I remember the more I'd listen to those guys, the more I'd find them quite entertaining, quite fun, and not as nuanced on the topics, but very aggressive. So I found that very interesting and captivating. So I'd go towards them a little until eventually I was sort of in that classical liberal side of, you know, the facade of like essentially what is civic nationalism coded underneath another layer of fascism. So when I was noticing that, not too late, but not too recently, I started to come back towards progressive side of politics into what I am today.
Yes, we are very, very glad to have you on our side. I would not want to try to. Yeah, I would not be wanting to analyze your articles and trying to find fault in them coming from the other side, because they're very, very well written. You source everything. I'm really impressed with your articles, man. I'm really impressed with the way you write, and I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Have you ever considered a career in journalism, like writing for a newspaper?
That's sort of what I'm doing right now, but not a newspaper. That'd be amazing. I'd love to work for a newspaper, but to see it all in print, that very classic sort of, dad, look what I did. But I do work for a website, so I write on Medium, but also write on TrekTed.com, which is where I publish all my articles as well, and they're the ones I sent you guys. So mm-hmm.
I always see TrekNet, I think this was called TrekTent on Twitter. Yeah. I always see them like mention you in a post. They're like, oh yeah, look at this article written by your Twitter name is funny too. I like it. Atheist Cunt. It's like, look at this Twitter article written by Atheist Cunt. And I'm like, oh yeah, he's getting recognition.
I know. I love writing that on any sort of website that I can, or game I can write that on. They'll have to address me by that.
Yeah. It's part of the art of shit posting, like having these articles like acknowledge your name, because you know it is really well written and your name doesn't take away from it. By the way, guys, every single article that we're going to talk about today, as well as a few others by Bailey, we are going to have in the links to the episode in the description of the episode below, so please go and check him out, please go and support him. So absolutely, yeah, you said the first one that kind of like gave us insight into your journey from the more reactionary side to the left, where we love you, is one of the articles was called The Making of a YouTube Radical, Why Reactionaries Hate Critique, if I can read my own handwriting here. And you detail a lot of your own path down the YouTube pipeline. So we've talked about that a little bit on the show previously. And you had a lot of really good insights into that YouTube pipeline. If one of the things that you wrote that I really, really liked, you said the YouTube pipeline never starts with the crazies. You never start with James Alsop. You never start with Stefan Molyneux. You start with kind of the more moderate and centrist people, and then YouTube's algorithm loves to kind of throw you that way. I think Oreo has mentioned really similar things in the past. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Tell us more. Give us some more insights into that, please.
Well, regarding my personal journey from that side, I remember I was very interested in, because I remember I started when I was, because it's very hard to describe what I was. It was very flip-floppy between each sort of side, so I wasn't really rooted in any real philosophy, I suppose, but more into entertainment, who's saying really provocative things and very funny things and who's got some insight behind it, I suppose. So when I was watching things, I was starting off with TYT, I remember, and I'd watch them, I'd find them all very passionate, you know, Ben Mankiewicz, Cenk Uygur, Anna Gasparin. I still like TYT to a fair bit, even though they get a lot of shit on. But I remember I was very interested in Jimmy Dore a lot, especially after the DNC scandal with Bernie Sanders. And I remember he also went on Dave Rubin's show. It was about a year before both of them started getting traction for why they were famous, I suppose. So I remember I watched Dave Rubin's show and I was like, oh, he's a very interesting guy. He's got, you know, people I like all across the spectrum, I suppose, on there. Like, he's got Sam Harris as well. I was interested in him because he's sort of a liberal, I suppose. I know he's very controversial, but I still see him as a liberal, I suppose. And then eventually I'd start watching Dave's show more and I'd be like, oh, there's this guy Milo Yiannopoulos on. I was like, I wonder, he looks very interesting. He's very suave. I love suits. I might watch that. And he's a funny guy. And when I'd watch him and I'd be like, that's very interesting. I never thought conservatives could be funny. I suppose I always think of them as Ben Shapiro types of like, you know, suit and tie, talking fast, not giving a shit, but not being smart enough to actually be witty, I suppose. So I remember I'd watch Milo a lot and I'd find him very funny and fascinating, and I'd go to Sargon of Akkad next. He was also on Dave's show, and Dave would not mention the very controversial stuff behind their characters. He'd mention the very sort of milquetoast issues of like, oh, you support free speech? And I'm like, yeah, I support free speech as well. And I'd slowly go down and down until I start consuming their content on their own, and they'd give me sort of very weird issues of like, oh, feminism is sort of opposed to these sort of issues, and I wouldn't hear the social justice side of why they'd oppose it, or if they would oppose it, or why their stats say this, and why I'd be hearing, because I mentioned in the article, I'd be hearing the social justice lens through the mouthpiece of their critics, not through the actual people. So I think that's sort of a thing about these reactionary spheres, is that they're inherently echo chambers. And if you keep going down and down, you start going into more echo chambers, and it's a very, very lonely place, because you start hearing your own thoughts read back to you. Yeah, until they start going into debates, and that's how I got out of it, was when you hear, which is similar to my story of just Destiny beating the shit out of people, or Vosh going on other channels beating the shit out of other people and being very productive in that same way as well, but actually, you know, being open to discussion.
That actually, yeah. So we've talked about this a little bit before. Shit posting, when we say it's an art form, we've had a few guests say that it's an art form, that's not facetious. Like, that's not just a joke. There is some value to be had in countering a lot of the narratives surrounding, because you do only hear, a lot of people do only hear about SJWs through the lens of a lot of reactionary types like that. So, so things like shitposting and humor and being able to spar with a lot of
comedy. You know, comedy is an art form. And,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's an underrated art form, if there ever was one, in cinema, in art, in because I think of the Dada days when they would have, because you know Tim Pool, right? He made that video recently about like, this isn't a meme. And he'd be like critiquing the reasons like why. Yeah, bottom text isn't a meme when it is a meme. Yeah. He just doesn't get it. But I was thinking, like, it's very much like Dada, the art form, where they would, back in, I don't know the era, but there would be someone who made a toilet as like a sculpture. Yeah. And they'd be like, that's not real art. It doesn't say anything. And they'd be like, no, it's subversive. It's saying that you're a bunch of stuck up idiots. And it's just making people laugh. It's a comedy. So that sort of form, it's like memes are that sort of thing, even though they are a joke. Obviously, we're being semi-facetious when we talk about it, but it's how it drags people in, and that's how you have meme terrorists sort of laughing about the shooting as like just another meme, even though they do have a real ideology behind it. They are also laughing about it, like, oh, you know, despite, and then gets the whole room laughing, and to anyone reasonable, they'd be like, "That you're disgusting."
Right.
Yeah, I obviously have a ton of thoughts on comedy and how you know, humor is rhetoric and stuff like that.
I did see your video. That I found that very interesting.
Oreo, what do you think of how a lot of reactionaries, and I guess more lefties now, are using memes and shitposting as a way to convey ideas?
It's very, I want to say it's very effective, because in today's society, when we want to discuss ideas, we usually do it through comedy. I mean, we've always done that. But with memes and how the internet, and like during the rise of the internet and like meme culture and all this stuff, I think the right has found a way how to put their ideas into memes in order to get it across easier to audiences or people that don't know, like the idea of, I guess you could say stochastic terrorism, how basically when you walk up to someone on the street and you make a meme about, and let's say you tell a joke about black people, right? Now it's a joke, but its purpose from the speaker is malicious. It's meant to basically be a terrible joke about black people, but the person who is analyzing it, if they don't know what the person's talking about, they can't see how they're structuring it, they'll say, oh yeah, you know, that is kind of true when you think about it. So then, you know, it goes from jokes to basically going diving into their ideology, then into their ideology to potentially accepting it if you don't really know what you're doing. I feel like that's how the right's pretty much been effective.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I would say that's very, very true, because when you have channels that are very comedy-based, like a Steven Crowder sort of show, which is... I very much sympathize with David Pakman, who went on Joe Rogan's show and said, looked into the camera very despairingly, I had no idea he was a comedian. I thought he was just a commentator. So I very much sympathize with that, because they write their jokes in a way that is not critical or satirical. It's in a reinforcement of their own ideas. And if you are not very clued into who they are and you know them as a person, like if you know Crowder and you go, oh, he's not, you know, he doesn't hate trans people because I know him personally and he is very polite around them and he'll say their pronouns, blah, 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 assuming that is even Crowder. I very much doubt that. But even then, you could get the idea when he tells those jokes, you could go, oh, see, he's just kind of saying it in a jovial way. He doesn't really mean it. But if you're an audience member, you kind of go, oh, yeah, tranny is a... that's a thing, you know, we have to deal with. We have to stop that. We have to legislate that. And this very funny man is telling me the truth. And that's the problem with seeing comedians as your truth tellers as well. It's like if they're not funny and they're not saying the truth, they are just making you laugh. And you sort of fall into that sphere.
Oh yeah. So if it's not, if it's not obvious to the audience who is actually watching by my gray hair and general demeanor, I'm quite a bit older than both Oreo and Bailey, and so both of them mentioned.
I'm losing hair, so we can't judge it that much. Go on.
Yeah. So I'm 29, which puts me in almost an age bracket above Oreo and Bailey both here. And both of them mentioned that they got a lot of their introduction into politics was through Gamergate. And not to put too much of an age divide on everything, but a lot of times when you're growing up in your like mid-teens, for a lot of people, not all people, but a lot of people, that's when you're first starting to kind of get your political ideology, like start developing political opinions. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, and I want to hear your all's input on this to see if I'm completely off, your first political opinions are going to come from people who are the most entertaining to watch, because politics can be very boring. You know, very few 15-year-olds are watching C-SPAN to get informed political opinions. They're getting them from people who are entertaining. And whoever is the most entertaining and whoever can make the best jokes and appeal the most to an audience who is there for entertainment, well, that does plant those ideas a little bit more firmly than someone who's just telling them straight. Do you guys think that there's any truth to that, and why Gamergate was so successful among young people?
I find that very, very truthful, because, not to quote Andrew Bright, but with too much credit, politics is pretty much downstream from culture. And when you intertwine those sort of things into a sort of package that is very appealing to people, it will generate an audience. Just, looking at the policy. This is why I sort of have a disagreement with Carl Kalinske, I suppose, because he's very much policy focused, but not very much optics focused. So when you're thinking about optics, you got to think about what sort of message delivers, I suppose. And so when people are critiquing Kamala Harris for saying the word retarded in a thing against Trump, all the Twitter people are going to go liking what she says, and they have legitimacy behind why they don't want her to say it, because it is very mean to retarded people, but it works well for politics of her crowd. So when she says those sort of things, people are going to defend her and be like, oh, you're being too PC. And then Sargon of Akkad's going to back her up and be like, oh, see, she's being policed by her own. The left are reading their own. So you should come over to us because we're more fun. And when you join the people who are more fun, you start to realize, oh, they're very fun in the rhetorical sense, but they're not very fun in the social and political economic enforcement of their own communities. That's sort of the double-edged sword, I suppose, is that, oh, do you want to live in a society that gives you free money and it lets you and like sort of, bugs you about the sort of words you say, even though it's essentially just amounts to bugging them instead of enforcement of speech codes, blah, blah, blah. Or do you want to go with the guys who are like, oh, yeah, you can say anything, but if you speak about against the flag or you speak out against the military industrial complex, you'll be rather. So that's sort of the dynamic we're sort of dealing with, even though there are people in between who are like, no, we can reject that. We can say what we want and we can give people free money if we want to. You know, that's sort of the thing I'm trying to spear.
Yeah, free money definitely. Yeah, free money definitely gets people's attention. Yeah, so a lot of people, that is
an optics thing for Andrew Yang. Just bang, 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 dollar, and it gets people coming.
Yeah, the internet has introduced this entirely new political landscape where you're not just taking the politics of your family and the people around you. You're introduced to a lot of different people, and so you do tend to like go with who would you like to be around the most. And this is completely out of the blue, but both of you guys started that way and you kind of came back to the left, and we really love to have you. So thank you both for that. But when they did have to start going from more entertainment to when they had to get serious on topics and they actually had to tell you what they believed, is that, am I off base by saying that, oh, now that they're getting serious and I have to actually, you know, take their opinion seriously, oh man, I do not like what I'm hearing.
Yeah. So that's the thing about Trump supporters is that I was never really a supporter of Trump, but I did find that crowd very entertaining. And I remember I watched a video of an Antifa supporter in front of Shia LaBeouf. You remember Shia LaBeouf's artistic project of like He Will Not Divide Us, where everyone would come up and go on that video camera outside of DC. Yeah. But I remember there were Antifa supporters there who were like, oh, I really believe in anti-fascism, but these shit posters are very fun. I like love interacting with them. And you could see that she was on the cusp of like becoming a centrist type who's basically going to go down that pipeline of like, my own community is very toxic to how I function as a jovial, sort of loving, you know, comedy-loving person. And when those crowds started to get actual political power, which is the one good side about that side getting actual political power, is that the optics of them being these, like, you know, anti-establishment people starts to turn to a house of cards, because you realize, like, oh, he's having secret meetings with the Taliban, but didn't you go on the campaign trail saying, like, oh, we should defund these sort of extremist sort of countries? And you start to notice, hey, your rhetoric's not matching up with your policies. Mm-hmm. And same with Trump's like big money stuff about like, oh, Clinton, she's bought by Wall Street. But then you'll see that he hires the president of Goldman Sachs and his lower cronies into the economics division. They'll do the exact same policies that Clinton would do, except worse. So you start to notice that these crowds, once they start getting power and they start doing these terrible, generally terrible things to the country, that unless you actually have good backing behind them. But words do matter if you actually want to sustain your own power. So the dynamic I'm seeing in real world politics and as well as cultural online shit posty politics.
Is that kind of in line with what you've noticed, Oreo?
Yeah. No, I was the opposite of Bailey. I was a bit of a Trump supporter. I wouldn't say full on, because I would still like criticize him for some of the dumb shit he said, but but like it was sort of like not really a supporter, but you know, oh yeah, I can see where he's coming from. I was too dumb. I was so dumb back then. Like when he made the comment about Africa and Haiti being shithole countries, I think, like, when I look back on it, I think I used to argue against people like my mom just because of the fact that, you know, usually, like, when you, like, with teenagers, like, we try to, like, go away from our parents' beliefs and we try to form our own beliefs. So when she was like, oh, yeah, what he said was racist, I would make the argument, oh, no, mom, what he said wasn't racist. What he said, in fact, was kind of true when you look at it. And I think I was doing that just because, oh, yeah, like she's a liberal. You know, like watching these videos and then you learn about liberals and it's like, ew, liberals are nasty. Ew, like, I don't want to, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to talk to liberals. They're nasty. Ew, like they're the enemy and stuff like that. So I would look at my mom as that, but like, I guess over time, I kind of got the sense that, oh, yeah, these people aren't bad. Like, you know, this side is saying they are. They're actually pretty good. But now that I'm a leftist, it's still a dynamic of, oh, yeah, neo-libs, ew.
I think, yeah, Bailey, what you said earlier about hearing about a side purely through the lens of their enemies or their opposite side, I think that was like really on point. And
it's sadly not my point. I do believe in that point, but someone better than me articulated it was a current affairs writer. I forget his name. I'm so sorry for him. But you just go into current affairs, he's been on Majority Report as well. He talks about how people will say the things of social justice through their own more hateful rhetoric of saying like, pick a topic of like feminism. Toxic masculinity, for example, like that is a very hard position to argue if you're going off the anti-social justice side of, oh, all masculinity is toxic, right? That's a very collectivist point of view, which I find very ironic. And irony is the thing that makes these people quite fun to laugh about. Is it's very hard to argue against that, but you can be like, oh, but they're not arguing against that. You're being collectivist right now. You're being very broad right now. It actually means it's emphasis on the toxicity part, that men have a general trend towards these sort of toxic behaviors. And if you can see ground, hey, toxic femininity exists as well through things that women do, like catty bullying instead of physical bullying, for example. They will use that point as like a gotcha, be like, oh, but what about toxic femininity? And you go, yeah, what about it? You know, we're critiquing that as well. We hate terse, we hate swears, we hate all these people. We're criticizing these people. What about you? Are you criticizing these people? Oh, no, you just want to put them back in the orthodoxy Russia where they're subservient and don't wear shoes. You know, so that's the sort of thing. You've got to hear what they're actually saying, and then you've got to critique it from that point of view.
Yeah, well, that's as good a transition as others. That's as good as a transition as I think I'm going to get. You also write a lot about the intellectual dark web. Can you talk a little bit about the IDW and what you think it is, what you think if they stand for anything collectively, what do you think about the IDW?
Well, that's the thing. They're very amorphous by design, but also not, because it's a movement of inherent conflict with itself, because a lot of the people that they accept, you've heard of Karl Popper's intolerance paradox, you know, where you can't intolerate the intolerant for society.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of their shtick, is if they had people, if the funny thing is that their worst detractors of it are the people who are the best of it. So Joe Rogan will laugh at him like, oh, we're the super best friends. Like it's not a thing. We don't like, or Sam Harris will even criticize him all you want for whatever opinions he has. But he's like, he notices like in that New York Times article, he'll be like, there's people in this movement who don't criticize Trump like at all. Like we kind of have to work that out. And people will skip that little part of Barry Weiss's interview with all of them, because they'll be like, oh, look at the IDW, they're all collective. And it's like, no, they're having their own divide right now. And that's why you see people like Quillette, Claire Lehman, people who have blocked me, all of them, having fights with Dave Rubin, who has also blocked me because I've criticized all of them for their little shitty conflicts. So that's the sort of thing, is that they have an intolerance sort of infection diseasing their little shtick, and you know, they're gonna slowly go away.
There was a description that you had that I really, really liked. I can't remember if it was yours or someone else's in your article. A few bad partisans still poison the diversity of the intellectual dark web. There's a phrase you used. They would almost self-describe themselves as marginalized moderates. And I really, really like that. So do you think that this current divide in the intellectual dark web, do you see this as a good thing? A healthy thing?
I do. It makes me very thankful for politics being a very debatable, contestable field by design, because if the intellectual dark web had a unity behind it, it would be exactly what my piece describes. It would be a alliance, front line against, it would be a reactionary alliance against social progress. And that was something that Yuri Harris mentions in his Quillette articles as well, which I highly recommend. And the only articles I will recommend from Quillette is he says, if the intellectual dark web is what it claims to be, which it is not, it would be more accepting of social justice similar to me, and that I critique cancel culture, I critique tech from a censorship, monopolization, due process position. I critique a lot of these things. I critique language as well. I critique all these things, but they block me. Quillette blocks me. Claire Lehman blocks me. So they're hypocrites as well. But Dave Rubin will block me because I criticize him for not adhering to, for outflanking him, for not adhering to his own principles.
Just okay.
And
just,
that is something I find very healthy to debate, that they actually cannot stand is debate. They can only stand alliances against reactionary thought. And that's what my piece tries to critique is.
Yeah, just so our audience knows, Bailey's Twitter like presence is really, really great. Like, it's very nuanced. He doesn't insult people for the sake of insulting him. He'll shitpost, but he's not there to like just to troll people for the sake of causing like.
I'm no troll. Like, I don't. Yeah. I like trolling. I don't like troll culture.
Yes,
I critique troll culture as well.
Yeah. So for someone like Claire Lehman, who wants this kind of diversity of opinion, to block him, I think is a pretty big statement that I didn't want that to go unrecognized.
I make a very specific point to highlight all the people who have ever blocked me from the discourse. I have an entire chain of all the people who have blocked me, and it started off back when I was a bit more reactionary than I am now. Is that I have Anita Sarkeesian who blocked me, and admittedly I did call her a cunt, but for a good purpose. But then I also have Candace Owens who blocked me for saying, "Oh, you're transphobic against Blair White," and she's like, "Nope, you're gone." You know, but you know, free speech on. I've worked for PragerU. So if she wants to adhere to her own company's principles, unblock me, please. You are violating my cross-constitutional rights.
Cross-constitutional American rights.
But then I have an entire thread of all the people who have ever blocked me, and it turns out, I did a political compass test of all the people who are on it, and turns out left libertarian is all the people who don't have me blocked. So freedom. I'll stick with those people. Thank you.
Oria, what do you have to say about the intellectual dark web and Bailey's description of it?
I think it's pretty spot on. I don't know that much about them. So
all the better for it. You're not missing much. It's the same old conservative liberal talking points that are all being divided up into different camps. And Sam Harris acknowledges that. And that's why he doesn't really say he's part of the intellectual dark web. He kind of just says it jokingly. Instead of Eric Weinstein, he's like, no, the intellectual dark web is a very important movement. It's like, no, you're describing every political divide ever. You're not on the dark web.
Yeah, I know like Joe Rogan, Dave Rubin, and Christina Hoff Sommers. I know that they're a part of it, but I think there's more members, if I'm not mistaken.
Joe Rogan as well. He's sort of distanced himself from it. Again, all the fun people who are not in that, who are like the best of that movement, they're not really part of it. So if you buy into the intellectual dark web, it turns out you're a bit of a hypocrite. So don't join it.
It's one of those things. I love the idea of having people like, yeah, we're going to accept a bunch of opinions and fight them as upfront as we can. So I do like a lot of communities where I find a lot of Discord servers where everybody agrees with me. I'm glad that they exist, but they're also a little bit boring to me. And I realize that's a certain type of person, but I love hearing those opinions. I love arguing. My name is SJW Debates. I love arguing. So I like the idea. I love the idea.
Adrenaline pumping.
Yes. Oh man, it is like when I've done debates before, it's like I get that like adrenaline rush. And there's a small version of it when there's someone who's like when I see someone online like, this is a dumb point, you're really stupid, I'm like Oh yeah, we're about to get into it. I realize
yes, I gotta say something funny here. I gotta put in that little joke, and then it's like a little snipe. I prefer to snipe instead of debate. It's like just say something really funny that kind of dismisses their point of like how stupid it is to my audience, and people just seem to eat it up. I suppose them.
Yeah, I think you have the better approach. I'm not good at the one-off snipe. I'm more the type who I'm more the sad sack, like the Jerry from Rick and Morty, who would sit there and refresh. I'm like, what's he saying now? Refresh. Oh, come on, I need to know. Need you.
Snipes don't get everyone, but they do get some people like me.
yeah, be more like Bailey than you are like me. Don't sit there and like waste your entire evening arguing with like, don't be the 20 response chain underneath a random Twitter thread like I am.
I do have my chains sometimes, you know.
All right. I think the last actual topic that we that I wanted to go over with you is that we do have a problem with big tech monopolies. So YouTube is basically like the platform. Of course, there's other ones like BitChute and other things like that, but
they're not as big as YouTube.
It's not even a competition. Like, it's really fair to say that Twitter, Facebook, YouTube all have almost a monopoly on what is the largest exchange of speech on the internet. And
just to add some context, that is definitional. Elizabeth Warren talks about this all the time, is that they're not monopolies in the traditional sense, they're monopolistic. So if you check out their market share, we define monopolies is by their market share and how much income they have and how much attention they do have from the public. And definitionally, these websites do have a monopoly status. They have, you know, 70%, 80% all encompassing on their collective apps each. And they're not all the same. They're not all competing with each other. They're all their own monopoly within their own sort of niche, I suppose. So Twitter really isn't a monopoly, I suppose, because, you know, there's other sort of websites that do what Twitter does, like, but like Gab, I suppose. But, you know, it is technically-ish.
That is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Look at how Bailey, like...
But Facebook, YouTube... Even the things I'm trying to use as a counterpoint to my own piece, they're sort of it is what it is. But it like that doesn't have really a market share. Right. But if you talk about YouTube, Facebook, I can't even think of any other ones. they have like billions of people on it. They have billions in income coming, and if you get removed from those platforms, you're gone.
That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Look how Bailey is making this nuance. He's using like the definitions of words. He's taking this from a very, very good place that we don't see a lot. So I hope that's hopefully
struggling.
Struggling
to do it.
No, you're not, because you're actually thinking about what you're saying. A lot of people, when they hear like big tech monopolies are like stifling free speech, that the instant like alarms go off. Like, oh no, what are they actually talking about? What are they actually trying to say here?
Is Bailey wrong? And then they will look into it and be like, no, he's actually critiquing how it functions. He's not just saying it because he can say it and it sounds funny in an article, which it does, but you know, that's definitional. You look it up. You know, Big Oil used to do the same shit. It used to be a very big market share.
Yeah, so you approach this from a way that is very, very, very needed, and we really appreciate you, the work that you put in on all of your articles, but especially this one, because this is an issue that needs a left-wing critique when a lot of people are only hearing critiques from the right. So you are getting at it in a very, very good way. Particularly, I love your piece. Journalist Tim Pool fails to expose Twitter's accountability crisis. You did a really good piece there. I really, really liked that one. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So Tim Pool, fake journalist, commentator, beanie man. I do wear a beanie as well, so I won't attack him from that point of view. But Tim Pool went on Joe Rogan's podcast to do wasn't a debate, it was a interrogation of the Twitter people, Jack Dorsey and his trust and safety team leader, who I forget her name, but she was very good in that conversation, is that Tim Pool was trying to be the liberal fighter of big tech. And how did he, my article was like, okay, I'm not a liberal. I'm a libertarian. I like people having freedom to say what they want. And I like the idea that we have a public commons to say whatever we want. You know, public square, we can shout out, you know, we need, you know, UBI right now. We need universal healthcare right now. YouTube's the same effective thing. You get your little podium, you say what you want, right? So, okay, I'm very interested. Let's see what Tim Pool has to say. And what does he do? He attacks it from a very partisan, biased point of view of, why are you attacking conservatives from it? My point of view of what a conservative is versus what a liberal is. And it's an absolute shit show. It is terrible how he tries to attack these people, because they go, no, we've done the studies. Here's how, on the topic of transgender, misgendering or harassment, for example. Now, I find myself very hard to define harassment. So I would like, so if I was in that room, I would have liked them to define what is harassment versus non-harassment. Right, but Tim will be like, no, why are you labeling misgendering as harassment? Because conservatives don't agree that gender is a social construct. They don't agree that saying this word is harassment. Why are you doing that? And I just find myself cringing at this man, baby, talking to these people like he's not, like they're not adults who have thought about the studies of like, hey, this is, language is linked to how they sort of feel themselves. This is a fact. And then he'll be like, oh, but the Daily Wire has their own facts. It's like, Tim, they're a jerk. They're not journalism. They're not even a, they have their own talking points. So I found that very disturbing. And he couldn't attack them from any point of view that was legitimate, from how they handle cases, what constitutes harassment versus hate speech.
Yeah, in your article,
that is not from a biased point of view. I'm cringing.
So yeah, no. In your article, you go into a lot of his critiques just amounted to whataboutisms. It wasn't it wasn't going for definitions. It wasn't trying to nail them. Like, why are you doing the things you're doing? It's like, why are you? Most of his critiques were, why are you censoring these people while also not censoring these people on the left? It's like he didn't come off either way. He wanted the fairness. He wanted the people that he doesn't like either censored, because the same rules or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Just to jump in, there is a difference between a positive fairness and a negative fairness, similar to positive rights and negative rights. Is that positive fairness would be like, okay, we have terms of service that is constructed, that should be constructed by people who are in charge of the public forum, I suppose, right? So I would say that terms of service should be reformed in how it is constructed, how, what is under it, and how it is enforced, right? So similar to a due process sort of thing for social media sites. Tim, he will say he's arguing from a free speech point of view, which I appreciate if he actually did it, but he does not. He goes from a negative justice point of view of, why aren't you censoring the Antifa people who are giving me a problem? And and to his credit, he, after the interview, he said, I'm not going to give you these specific accounts, but during the interview, I will give you these specific accounts that are harassing other people, you know? So he's saying like, oh, I don't want to get in trouble for doing the things that I'm pushing, but I'll get other people in trouble for the people I am pushing. You know, it's a very deceptive sort of thing. So Tim is not a good actor at all in this sort of field. Ever. So, just to be very clear, I'm very nuanced about my takes. Tim is not a good actor for maybe video games. Yeah, the one thing he's maybe okay.
The one thing where he's maybe okay, video games. Well, I guess that's something, right? Though, I mean, video games do matter a little bit. They're a part of the culture.
Yeah, I'll get people. Saying like, oh, look, Temple's attacking Trump, and they'll link me the video game tweet of like, video games don't cause violence. I'm like, Tim, you're stuck in 2006.
Like, maybe there's something more substantive you could criticize Trump for. I think a lot of the people,
maybe the camps, maybe.
A lot of people, when they say, try to link, a lot of people when they try to link stuff that says that Tim Cole has criticized Trump, the extent kind of boils down to either the video games, or he'll say something like, now I don't agree with Trump on everything, but the people arguing against him are doing this. Like, just saying that he doesn't agree with Trump is enough to apparently prove that he criticizes Trump in a lot of places.
I said that candid. It's always, I feel the red, my red cheek blossoming into a red army of anger towards him. There's always so backhanded how he does it. He doesn't do it from a good faith sort of place. So when I attack him for being a bad faith actor, he'll accuse me of being a bad faith actor of not watching his own videos, which is quite funny. I have an entire thread.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Oreo knows this. I have an entire thread where he replied to me one time and goes like, "Ha, you didn't watch the video." And I go, and I just gave him all the timestamps of all the times he was mocking a sex worker for being banned on Twitter, saying like she's the worst
single. Like point of the point. Video where Tim is just like being a fucking idiot. He's just like
against his own right. values, outflanking him, saying like, "Oh, you call her the worst example of millennial nonsense. You say losing a Twitter account isn't the biggest deal in the world. You say I will be glad if I lose my Twitter account because it means I will have less stress in my life," which is like that last one is true, but you're going against your entire grift. So,
and I know he also did a comparison to like a farm worker at some point. He's like, "Oh yeah, see, like farm labor, it's like back-breaking work. Like being an influencer, it's nothing." I'm like, "But Tim, she's still making considerable money from this. Like I can see why she's upset. She lost her income, like her only
your
form
entire
of income.
Career, right? Is built on that intellectual trade, intellectual labor." And she can't even
this
do
is like
the labor.
I would imagine that Tim Pool, he probably would have a. Artists, like not in the sense of like music, but like say like a painter, like say if they were in that exact situation and like they lost their, I think in that situation it was an Instagram account, but like yeah, let's say if the painter had a Twitter account, like they posted photos on and like they get suspended or they like get banned from the platform and they're like, "Oh, this is the only way how I make my money, like what am I gonna do, like you know, this is where I was getting the most attention to where my work." Tim Pool, "Oh yeah, you know, but it's not like being a farmhand, you know, that's like back-breaking labor, like painting photos."
So what about it, Tim? Again, it's exactly diverting from the topic you're meant to be defending, is that just imagine, to go off your point, imagine if there was one gallery that hosts all the art in the world that is very super serious, and there's a sort of trade sex work that is considered a joke when it should not be. It is a form of labor like anything else. Mm-hmm. Artistry is a form of anything else, and if they wanted to have their own little sex art sort of thing where they show their tits, you know, you'd have a competition in the market that would allow you to sell that sort of trade. But for Tim, he's like, "Oh, big gallery does not accept sex work. You cannot display your tits in here, madam. Go away." But then when it comes to conservative art or conservative memes or anything, he'll be like, "Oh, yes, this big gallery is destroying my very existence." And he'd be right to say so, but he doesn't argue from an actual point of view. He argues from a partisan point of view that makes him more money. So that is my critique of him, is that I always outflank him from his own positions from the left. And yeah, he cannot withstand. He crumbles like a house of cards.
Yeah, and that's another does a point. Good job.
That's another point that's always brought up on the internet, is how conservatives, well, the grifters, at least, they always seem to make the most money. Or like conservatives when, like, I think the most recent example is Kyle. Oh my God, what's his last name?
Oh, Kashov.
Kashov, yeah. Like, he didn't get accepted into Harvard because he said racist and bigoted shit. And then Dave Rubin's like, "Oh, well, why don't you come on down and be my, was he like a communications director? Why don't you come on down and be my communications director? Get this coach money." It's like, oh my God.
There's something article coming out.
You got an article coming out on that? No, let's hear about your article first.
I have an article. I can release it at any point. It is already finished, but it's on my Trick Tent right now. I got to release it on Medium. But it's about like how Dave's another one. When we say grifter, we're being a little bit facetious and we're not, because we know that these people have a message. All right, mm-hmm. We can argue from that point of view and say like, "Oh, this is why you're wrong." And I don't tend to disagree sometimes with some of their points of view if it is within the bounds of a genuine place of freedom for general people to interact online. Like, I don't disagree with that. But right. When I argue with these people, it is not from that point of view. It is because they have a side that they're arguing against for a political weapon, and for that happens to aim for themselves, and that is, must be the reason why they're not critiquing their own in that sort of sphere, is that it's to maintain a sort of power. So when we say that, because they are not arguing from a genuine good place.
Yeah, I always wanted to ask a lot of these so-called free speech advocates, they always... So free speech is worth protecting because words have power, correct?
Right.
So why would you dismiss a lot of harassment and a lot of like loss of income by saying, well, they're just words. It's not backbreaking labor. You're not doing anything important. You're just speaking. Like, I don't understand that. Like, if words...
As they say on their platforms, that makes money for their workers, which is what Dave Rubin is doing when he hires... Kyle to be his communications director. Communications, that is the trade, communication, right? Yeah. When you hire people for communications director positions, words have power. So when he does this and you critique him saying like, oh, here's my, why I'm a liberal, because I have this position, gay, married.
Yeah.
that's identity politics. That makes Milo Yiannopoulos a liberal. Okay, he married a black man. He is more liberal than you, Dave. But, you know, when they do it, they, you know, they don't admit words have power until it benefits them, which is quite funny.
Yeah.
What were you saying? You wanted to, about these liberal people, about their, that words have power. What were you?
You kind of hit the nail on the head. I was wondering why, because free speech is important because words have power. I think that's the entire point. Like, the reason we value speech and the reason we don't want that taken away from us is because words have enormous power. They influence action in enormous way, probably more so than anything else. And then to just outright dismiss things like harassment because, oh, you just got to toughen up. They're just words. Or to outright dismiss things like losing your Instagram account because, you know, there are swerfs attacking you. All these things are enormously important and enormously impactful on your life, and the position that they take just doesn't seem to be consistent at all.
And this is why I have a sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
And it's something that we sometimes do too. There is a lot of some critique to be had on the left there because we do it too, to a certain extent. I don't. Well, obviously I'm biased, but I don't think we do it nearly to the extent that they do. But yeah, I was wondering what your thoughts would be on that.
Like, you just avoid those crowds when I can. And when I get confronted, I try to be polite and be like, oh, yeah, I won't use that word. Okay. But then when I'm in a space of my own where I can say what I want, you know, I'll try to be as polite as I can, but also have a bit of freedom to do what I can. And this is why I have a problem with these people becoming tech people, right? So, Dave, as I was going to say before, the article I'm writing about is Dave Rubin joining the Blaze, right? So very liberal, the man joining a very conservative TV network, online network. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what the Blaze is. But what he does in that regard is that he's going to make his own tech platform, right? So he's going to let people make their own apps with their own terms of service because they got to have competition against Google or YouTube. And I'm like, Dave, that's what every other app does, okay? And then he'll be like, oh, I'm going to make my own free speech platform called ThinkSpot, right? And we're going to root out all the trolls because it's going to be subscription-based. And I'm like, okay, that's not new. That's something everyone else does, but okay. But he'll be like, oh, yeah, we're going to root out the trolls on it. And if you're turn out to be a troll, we're going to, you know, end your subscription. I'm not going to take your money. I'm like, Dave, that's a pro-censorship position you're taking. You understand the difficult position that you're going to be undertaking, right? You're just going to become the same people you're criticizing. So when these people do it, they can't really attack it from their genuine values because they hold no genuine values. They have no idea the responsibility they're undertaking.
Yeah, just to let you guys in the audience know, Bailey wrote an article called ThinkSpot says it's a censorship-free alternative to big tech. Here's why we should be skeptical. Again, just like all the articles we talked about, that link is going to be in the description of the episode, both on YouTube, and we also broadcast to all the major podcasting networks, so that link will be in the description for all of them. Yeah, you mentioned a lot of things, like there's a minimum word requirement. It's a subscription service, so you have to pay for it, to my knowledge, if I understood that correctly. And yeah, you're talking a lot about how, well, what you're saying, the things you're doing to make a little bit less toxic is a form of censorship. So you're not censorship free, you've just changed what you're censoring. So
yeah, you've changed the power dynamics, and that's the thing they'll easily dismiss, is that like, oh, leftism is about power dynamics, right? In regards to intersectionality or race or what, name any topic, right? Economics, I find that more fascinating because I am a leftist. I do critique economics quite a fair bit as a part of why I critique big tech, but they'll dismiss power dynamics at all. But then when it comes to them, they'll be like, oh, you're like Sagan, for example, he critiques power politics, but then he says, oh, but I have to join the EU because that, I have to gain sustained power to actually talk about the words that I'm talking about, and words have power, and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's really funny. It's genuinely really funny to see these people not know what they're talking about or misunderstand that they are doing the same things that, and this isn't a horseshoe theory thing. This is, they're talking about things that are public commons, talking dialogue, right? So it necessitates that people need power, people need language. Yeah, and this isn't a thing about like, oh, both sides do it. It's about how we live as human beings, and they don't understand because they live on the internet. They don't understand how to interact with people. To be dismissive of them, but that's don't live on the internet. Don't be a troll. Or you'll lose your mind.
You'll lose your mind. Or, you know, any thoughts on that? The whole, what are your thoughts on free speech and how it should be handled on the internet?
Well, I have a very interesting non-liberal position on free speech, I suppose. I suppose it's liberal in that, like, I support it. But then I think, like, oh, you know, violence is a form of free speech. We just regulate which ones are good and which ones are not. Like self-defense is like, I stand my ground on this property to defend myself, and I will use whatever means I can to do that. And I'm like, okay, so I suppose, you know, whatever. But then Antifa will do like their protests to be like non-violent. And if they are violent, they attack certain people. And if I had my perfect value system implemented in Antifa, they would attack genuine fascists. With milkshakes. Of course, that is so funny to me. But since we don't have perfect people, their free speech is questionable because they are doing it in an anti-fascist way for them, but not really anti-fascist. That is correct, or that is like legitimate freedom. That I would say, like I always judge freedom from what is legitimate to what is illegitimate, what is a positive freedom, such as using like gun control, for example. Like I support gun control because I think you have to adhere to the non-aggression principle when you buy a gun, you know, and libertarians blow their minds because they're like, that's not freedom. You're removing guns from murderers. I'm like, that's the point. They're taking freedom from people, you know? So I find that quite funny. So I think that's the point of view I always go from, is what freedom is legitimate, what freedom is illegitimate. Let's discuss that out in words, and to some extent, violence is the best way to do that, but I prefer words because words are funny.
Oreo, what about you? What are your positions on free speech? Are they similar to Bailey's? Is there anything that you would add or take away from that? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's pretty much what Bailey said about Antifa. I feel like their free speech, it's pretty much like, in terms of optics, it's good for them. It's anti-fascism for sure, but it's like, you know, to everyone else, it's like, oh yeah, look at all these thugs just attacking these poor people with, you know, different opinions. And it's like, well, they don't. Well, yeah, they have different opinions, but some of those opinions are, you know, they actually seek to hurt people. But yeah, I feel like Antifa, if like my system would be basically pretty much what Bailey said, like, but I kind of want to add on to it. So I guess on the internet, in terms of like a virtual space with Antifa, I feel like debunking any fascist like claims, like, you know, because it's obviously not true. So you have to pretty much find a way how to, you know, go against it. I would also say, I don't know about this one, I'm still thinking on it, but I think if you stand on like, if you look at it from a moral sense, it's pretty okay. Doxing fashion, like, or telling their bosses, oh yeah, like this person said this, or like they believe in this, and like they genuinely believe in that, you have evidence, you have proof, then I feel like that's okay. And of course, milkshakes, because That's a good way to fight fascism.
I think I sent one of those articles to you. And again, yeah, I see a trend is that a lot of these people don't like it when the left does something that they disagree with, but they say that they purport to push, right? So I argued that milkshaking is a Western tradition that goes back a few hundred so years of in France, you'll notice that they throw a lot of flour on politicians. I remember I think Macron got it. I know in Brazil they sort of use I think it's flour as well. Bolsonaro got it as well. You know, these are protest freedoms that do impede mm-hmm. on other people, but I think it's legitimate because they are political actors, and I don't think it's violent in the sort of "I am bleeding, I am hurt" sort of violence that is more severe. It is more like, "Oh, look, I got dunked on literally by the Antifa." You know, so I kind of see that as legitimate, even though it's like very, it's cheeky, it's IRL shit posting, you know, they just can't accept that sort of freedom as legitimate because they'll use any sort of legal means that they can to skirt around it. And you know what? I don't blame them sometimes. You know, if I got dunked on, sometimes I feel like, oh, I'll just call the, you know, if I was in that position, oh, I'll just call the police, blah, blah, blah. But you know,
you brought it back and admit beautifully.
What they do has faults and they can't do that.
You brought it back beautifully to the beginning. So we brought it back to shitposting IRL and how ridicule is one of the most powerful weapons that we have, especially against the people who are more powerful than us. So you brought it back beautifully. And I think that's a great thing to end on. Everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to episode 7 of the Debaterios podcast. We appreciate you so much. And we definitely appreciate Bailey helping us a lot and making this an extremely interesting episode. So thank you for staying up late to help us out, Bailey. Super cool, yeah, dude.
Thank you so much.
Again, by fast. I didn't even realize this an hour.
Again, all of his information is found in the links in the description to this episode. You can follow him on Twitter at @atheist_CVNT. You can read all of his articles and follow him on the various media outlets that he posts on. We'll have links to all the articles and more that we've talked about today. So thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. I have been Justin.
And I have been Oreo.
And
Bailey, as a Tartarian.
So thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you next time on the Debaterios podcast. Y'all have a great rest of your night, day, and wherever you are.
Bye-bye.